Live and in color from the NBC News Radio Broadcasting Studios of KCAA, 1050 AM, 102.3 FM, and 106.5 FM, located in beautiful Southern California, and in parallel from the Turf's Up Radio Studio in Fort Lauderdale, Florida. Thanks for tuning in to the Water Zone Show this evening.
All right, pleasant evening to everybody. This is Rob Starr along with Mr. Chris Davies. We're your hosts of the Water Zone Show, and I hope everybody's having a great day. It's a beautiful day. Chris is out in California. I'm out in the Arizona territory. And Chris, how are you doing today?
We're doing great, Rob. Appreciate you asking, of course, every single week. Interesting show tonight, a little bit of a twist in the schedule, if you will, with Miss Maven from Chris Austin from Maven's Notebook not joining us this week. We'll miss her.
Yes, but she's on a little field trip for her relaxation with her family, and we hope she enjoys it because she needs some time off.
And well deserved, by the way. But hey, listen, the time and the schedule is replaced by just as enthralling as an agenda as our listeners expect. So we're not going to let anyone down, are we, Rob?
Absolutely not. And we didn't have to pay you to say that either, so we appreciate it. Anyway, what's funny just for our people listening, as we have for the last year, and it's unbelievable thinking about it, it's been a year, a little more than a year, that Chris and I have not been going to the NBC studios because of the COVID situation. And sometimes it's difficult when we're not sitting next to each other in the control room and you know, looking at each other, and we accidentally step on each other when we're trying to talk, and we can't look at our engineer and wave to him, make funny faces or anything like that. So we appreciate the listeners sticking around with us. I know sometimes it's a little difficult, and we have some technical problems that crank up sometimes that unbeknownst to us. But we try to make it through the show and give everybody what they want. Well, we actually have two great guests today. I'd like to bring the first one on. His name is Andy Slack, and he's the principal of Arizona Sports Field Specialist out here in Arizona. And Andy, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Thank you. We do appreciate it. And we always like to start the show off with when we have a guest on who we've never had on, and just kind of understand, how did you get into this? How did you choose your career in getting into the water industry? And what made you do it?
Good question. What made me do it? I didn't know what I was getting into, so that's why I made the decision. No. Growing up, I grew up in a small town back in Indiana and worked on my uncle and cousin's farm as a kid. And when I went off to college, I thought I wanted to be an engineer. And I was a pretty good student in high school, but let's just say I wasn't a great student in college because I really didn't know how to study. So engineering didn't treat me that well. And I ended up finding out about a major called turf science that I never heard of. It was in the School of Ag under agronomy, which is a study of soil. And I started looking into it because I actually played golf in high school. And so because I played golf, I liked being outside, like being around the golf course. I heard about turf science major, and I ended up switching my major after about a year and a half in college and never looked back. Loved everything I did in turf and in the turf world. And most of my background's in the golf end of things. Worked on a golf course when I was in high school and or college, should I say, and then did golf construction while I was in college. And when I first got out of college, I initially was a golf irrigation salesperson for a Toro distributor back in Indiana at the time. So that's kind of how I headed it down this direction. And then that's how I got, I actually installed an irrigation system on a golf course one summer in college. So I got to know irrigation pretty well. And then when I got out of college, I was offered a sales and irrigation design job with a local distributor. So that's how I kind of got into the irrigation end of things.
Chris, you want to take it from here?
Hey, Rob, I was just going to say, just thinking to myself, sitting in here, how many times will we ask that question? The answer is somewhat similar, right? Like along the lines of sometimes your career path chooses you instead, right?
Yep, it does. Well, what's interesting? So in your career, what is, and tell me a little about what your business does. I mean, I know the title, but just for our listeners, what do you actually do for your business?
I actually do three different things currently. I own and operate a small local grounds maintenance landscaping company, and we have three or four or five relatively small clients. And so I deal with the water management. I deal with the, you know, the higher end stuff, project management sort of stuff for my contracting business. And then an offshoot of that is the Arizona sports field. We actually stripe and line and provide different contracting services for athletic fields locally. And then the third business is I actually do still do some irrigation consulting. I dabble in some irrigation consulting still. Don't really chase it, but if the phone rings and whether it's a golf course or an HOA or a cemetery or whatever, you know, if depending on my schedule, I'll always entertain doing some consulting here and there. So,
well, towards the end of your interview, if you give the information, people can contact you. You know, feel free to do that, because that's what the show likes to do, is promote the people that we have on the show and generate some more business for you, which is great. So in your daily things that you've been doing for the last X amount of year, over 20-something years, what has been the most challenging project you ever did? And then what? And then the second part of that is, what's some of the difficulties you have with some of your clients? you do not have to name who they are. But just to see, you know, there's people listening in who are want to be in the business or in the business, and they need some expertise, because they don't, you know, they need a mentor. So go ahead.
Okay. I would say the most challenging project, it was actually a very fun project, but it was also very challenging. When I was doing irrigation design and consulting full-time up until, 2012 or so. Anyway, I had a big project over in the Palm Springs area called the Annenberg Foundation Trust at Sunnyland. If anybody's ever been to the Palm Springs area, there's a family, the Annenberg family, owns a bunch of property there. They have a little 9-hole golf course on the property that was built years ago. And I want to say the whole property is a couple hundred acres. Anyway, we were hired to do the irrigation design for the golf course, and then worked in conjunction with another irrigation designer out of Southern California that he did the landscape surrounding the property. He designed the landscape surrounding the property. So that was a big project, a fun project, but had a lot of moving parts and very high expectations from a end result project or status. So, but it was fun. It was a fun project. And unfortunately, in the desert, most of the construction takes place in the middle of the summer. So that was, in fairness, some of the challenging aspect of it. It was probably 110 to 115 half the days we were on site doing work in the field.
Mm-hmm.
So, and then what was the second question? What were some of the challenges? What was your second question?
That you see when people contact you, I mean, do they call like for the water management? Because that thing, being water management in the last 5 to 10 years, has just grown to be a big thing and a most important thing. And more people, and like HOAs and sports fields and stuff, they're looking for people to help them do water management properly. And how do you see that and going into the future?
I see it continuing to grow. I got into it ahead of a lot of people. I was doing water management stuff back in the late 90s, early 2000s, or at least I was offering it then, and the concept mm-hmm. was kind of foreign to a lot of people. I was actually hired in 2008 to run the irrigation system at Torrey Pine when the U.S. Open was held there and Tiger Woods won it, because with it being a municipal course, the guy in charge just really wasn't comfortable with the people he had running the irrigation system. So I was hired to actually be on site for about 6 weeks leading up to the tournament to kind of dial in the irrigation system. But no, I think there's a lot of need for water management. I think in fairness, there's a lot of people that have hopped on the water management bandwagon and, you know, aren't as qualified as they could be, in fairness, from what I've seen. The other thing I'm a firm believer in, I think it's great all the irrigation manufacturers over the years have made the smart, you know, use smart technology and auto-adjust and things like that with the irrigation control system and such, and, you know, using everything from soil moisture sensors, weather stations, all that fun stuff. but I am still a firm believer that a human needs to have their finger on the operation of the system. Just setting it up and letting it go will most definitely save water. I don't question that in the least bit. But I also feel that if you have a human involved that's checking it and paying attention on a regular basis, walking things in the field, I honestly think you can save significantly more water if you have a knowledgeable person managing the irrigation. And again, the hardware and the technology, you could definitely make some headway in water savings, but I also feel if the right person or people are managing the water, you can see significantly more savings.
Yeah, Andy, I couldn't agree with you. You know, you can get all of the technology you want and the right equipment and follow the manufacturer's instructions for pressure and spacing and head placement and all that sort of stuff, but, you know, nothing beats the good old, eyeball once every other week or so, or every week or so.
Yep.
And finding out, because even in the exactly correctly installed system, there's going to be some inefficiencies, right? You can't get 100%. So couldn't agree with you more. That once every other day eyeball is the key.
Yep. No, and I worked for the National Cemetery Administration, which is a division of the VA, for about 5 years as their national irrigation engineer, traveling around the country, checking out irrigation systems on our national cemeteries. And the government had all kinds of, you know, we need to install efficient irrigation systems, we need weather stations, you know, we need, our uniformity needs to be so high, so on and so forth, which is all good. But if you still have a monkey sitting in front of the computer, it doesn't matter how much technology you install, that monkey, if they don't have the ability to actually run the system, then that's kind of a waste of money to go to that effort. So,
yeah,
and that, in fairness, in my opinion, goes back to some of the issues we have in our industry is we need a lot more training. We need so much more training of individuals, I think.
Yeah, even those people who do have their eyeball on the system, right? There's so many other conditions that can affect the efficiency and effectiveness of the irrigation system, like soil conditions, the turf health, exposure to the sun, slope, lots of different things, right? So unless you're tuned into all the factors that aren't, you know, set in stone, right? Then you really aren't truly managing the turf or the system.
Nope, I would agree. I would agree wholeheartedly with that. I'm with you. Somebody needs to take a walk in the field, whether every couple days, every couple weeks, whatever it is. And if you're managing someplace remotely and you don't have that built into your contract, I not that you won't do okay, I just don't think you can do as good as is possible in conserving water.
Yeah, you're right. You know, back in the early 2000s, the famous marketing word was set it and forget it. And that, you know, it was a great marketing tool at the beginning because every homeowner, at least on the residential side, thought that was really cool. You know, you just set this thing up and you never have to touch it again and don't worry about it. It's going to work fine. Well, as you pointed out, and Chris, it does not work fine all the time. There's still fine tune-ups to do that. And I truly believe that a lot of the bigger irrigation companies have put great thought and engineering diligence in putting together software to do measurements. I think instant feedback is important. I mean, the world is moving, at least in irrigation is moving to someday everything's going to be on the cloud and everything's going to be monitored from the, I mean, you go to Lowe's or Home Depot and you buy a refrigerator, you can hook it to your phone and your computer. Look at your door locks you can get from AT&T and you can control your locking and opening your door, turning the water on, turning off. Everything is going that way. What I worry about, and I had given a couple of speeches over the last couple of years about this, is, you know, everybody's going, you know, the Internet of Things with connectivity. The problem I see is just like if you turn on the news, all these countries are getting to get hacked, just like are the Colonial Pipeline, just like this JBS Meat Company. It was a shipping company out in on the East Coast. I worry about how safe is the Internet. And, you know, if they can crack what they're cracking now, you don't think they can crack into the Internet? I mean, it scares me to death thinking everybody's thinking that's the savior of all. But I worry about the security of that drastically. Your thoughts?
I would agree to some extent. I mean, the good news, bad news is we are just landscape and turf and irrigation. In many respects, unfortunately, our industry, the green industry, I guess I would say, is an afterthought and looked over from a significance and importance standpoint. And if someone were to hack into a, you know, I don't care, Toro, Hunter, Rainbird, any of the cloud controller companies, if somebody were to hack into their servers and screw stuff up, the reality is I would expect most of that data would be backed up and you may be offline for a day or two, potentially irrigation-wise, but it should be able to be maybe not fixed, but it could be, the data could be restored, or the people that were affected would still, once they got back online, would have the ability to get back into their controllers and set them up and get irrigation running again. That if there were, you know, damage, so to speak, you know, if they shut down irrigation on 1,000 sites in the summer, middle of the summer, the worst places to be affected would be the desert, Arizona, California, Vegas, whatever. And again, at that time of year, we're growing Bermuda grass that, you know, if it doesn't get water for a day or two, it's probably not going to kill it. And most of the plants get drip irrigation once, maybe twice a week. So again, could there be damage and could it be monetary? Yes. But unless it was down for a week or two during the heat, I don't honestly think it would be much to worry about.
I only learned, and I won't mention, you know where I live, but I won't mention it over the year. Not that I'm afraid to, but I just don't do that. But the courses here, two courses they have here, are the computer systems on the golf courses are tied into the restaurants that they own here. So I could imagine if they go in, yeah, because they didn't want to go out and buy separate software to segregate that. So they run it all on the same system. It takes forever to go pay your bill at the restaurants. Yeah, it's crazy. I didn't realize that until about a week ago, and I heard about that. And they said, so I could imagine, and I guess, and you have more experience in the golf world than I do, but thinking about that, they can shut the water down, but they can also kill their restaurants here because they won't be, they can hack into the billing and all of that. So, yeah, I worry about stupid things like that. Chris, any comments on anything?
Yeah, you know, as I told you, Rob, I got a question. I did have a question, Andy, for you, and it's relative to natural versus synthetic turf, right? And you can answer this in two parts if you want. The first is kind of commercial, on the commercial side, since I got a chance to read your background a little bit. You know, we've seen at Toro, we've seen a ton of work come along from not just professional sports and soccer and football stadiums and things like that, but colleges and universities where you've got this transition, this switch over from natural to synthetic turf. I guess from the first question there, you know, kind of what's your viewpoint on that? Do you see a lot of it there, especially where you're from and the part of country that you're from? And what's your thoughts, pros and cons, positive, negative?
I definitely think there's a place for synthetic turf. You know, my background being real grass, you know, having a degree in real grass, I'm more of a fan of natural grass. I just think it's a better surface, no matter what the situation, whether it's an athletic field, as it relates to injuries, I think it's bound to be softer than synthetic turf. I know it's cooler than synthetic turf. I know that for a fact, based on some research.
And it smells better when they cut it.
Exactly. And in fairness, I mean, in some respects, it helps, you know, keeping natural gas helps, grass, should I say, helps supply jobs. I mean, in fairness, in some respects, it's you know, it contributes to long-term jobs, not that the manufacturer of synthetic turf doesn't do that to some extent. But I am not a fan of synthetic turf for athletics. I understand the reasoning behind going to that. from a wear and tear and being able to use a field, essentially 24/7 if necessary. I do feel it's important from an irrigation standpoint to, if you go from natural grass to synthetic turf, you should keep the irrigation system in place and have the ability to cool the turf in a really hot climate like here in Arizona or Southern California. And also from a health and cleanliness standpoint, I know there's value in the irrigation system to flush off the sweat and blood and whatever else may have accumulated on the surface. And then you have the residential commercial setting. I definitely think I like the synthetic turf better in residential and commercial settings, because if you have small patches of grass, let's say 500 square feet or less, from a job standpoint, it's good to keep that. But if you put in synthetic turf and it's going to last 10, 15, 20 years, you know, you're helping your carbon footprint. You're doing a lot of things to where it's a lot less maintenance and therefore a lot less cost potentially. But then there's the downside of it. I think it's going to, in the long term, add to the urban heat island effect in large cities where there's a lot of heat, like here in Arizona. I feel there's a place for it. I just feel like many things, it's almost become a fad, and a lot of people have headed in that direction. And I think eventually we're going to see, especially in an athletic field setting, where a lot of schools end up going back to real turf. And in all honesty, I think real turf would be a better long-term surface if schools and facilities had the right people maintaining the turf and they had the right tools to maintain it properly from an aerification and compaction and verticutting and everything else standpoint.
Andy, people think that grass and trees and stuff don't breathe. They do. There's actually, respiratory gas exchange. And that doesn't happen with artificial turf or synthetic turf because there's no photosynthesis, right? So,
correct.
So it doesn't, you don't get the intake and carbon dioxide and the production of oxygen either.
Yes.
So, Andy, do you think? No, go ahead, Chris. Sorry.
I was just going to say, sorry, Rob, I didn't mean to jump in on you there.
No. As I said at the beginning of the show, since we're not sitting across from each other, it's kind of hard to know. Usually you'll bam me on the head and tell me to shut up and put your hand on my mouth while I'm talking, but I appreciate it. I know. Andy, real last question as we're coming up to a commercial break. So you talked about the heat instance with the artificial turf. What about that versus all the rocks that they put out here? Which is hotter?
Very, very good question. Very valid point. I don't know which is hotter. They're both pretty hot. I just know about 6-8 years ago when I was working for the National Cemetery Administration, I had an office over in the Scottsdale area at a local national cemetery, and we had installed synthetic turf on a gathering area at the cemetery just so they didn't have to maintain the turf and they didn't use the water and that sort of stuff. And myself and the agronomist for the National Cemetery Administration, we got a temperature gun, and we went out during the summer and the winter occasionally, and we would take measurements at the canopy, 2 feet above the canopy, 4 feet above the canopy. And I just remember the summer temperatures on the artificial turf, just above the canopy of the turf, was like 140, 150, 160 degrees. It was really hot. But we didn't do that test on the rocks. So I would assume the rocks probably aren't quite that hot, but they definitely retain the heat, so than the soil, more so than the soil would, I would assume.
Okay. So how do people get a hold of you if they want your services?
In fairness, they usually get a hold of me because they have a connection to me. I can be reached. Simplest way is email. I have an email address that's aslack@spotwater.com. It's kind of an old email address from my old consulting company, but there's so many people in the industry that know it. I've just continued to use it. But again, aslack@spotwater.com is the simplest way.
Great. Well, Andy, thank you very much for coming on the show. We certainly appreciate it and learned a lot about you and get some experience. I hope some of our listeners and the people in the industry have picked up on that. So, again, thank you very much. We owe you one, and you have a great week.
You too. Thanks for the opportunity. It's nice to talk to you guys, and best of luck. Thank you.
Thanks for coming on, Andy.
All right, we're going to take a little commercial break, and then we'll be on with our next featured guest. So stick around for the second half of The Water Zone.
This is 1050 AM KCAA Loma Linda and 106.5 FM Yucaipa.
Time to take a water break and talk some water. Irrigation. Such a refreshing topic. As more and more markets face water restrictions, your customers may be hungry, or should I say thirsty, for water-saving products. For new installations, add options like drip irrigation, controllers that respond to weather data, pressure-regulating heads, or heads with check valves. They all provide easy ways to differentiate your bids and win more jobs. Or for an extra stream of revenue, offer existing customers upgrades like high-efficiency nozzles, rotary nozzles, or Wi-Fi-based controllers. Because when you help your customers save water, you make a world of difference for the earth and your bottom line at the same time. We'll drink to that.
All right, welcome back to the second half of The Water Zone. You're here with Rob and Chris, and we appreciate you tuning in to us every single week. We got a special guest coming on, and actually our buddy Travis Luke from Travis Luke Communications caught up with a lady named Tara Moran, and she is president and CEO at the California Water Data Consortium, and they're located in Menlo Park, California. They're going to talk about some of the issues that they're having here in California in a little bit more depth. So, Travis, take it away.
Joined for this episode by Tara Moran. She is president and CEO of the California Water Data Consortium. Tara, I'm excited for this conversation.
Happy to be here. Thank you, Travis.
I was saying before we started recording that a lot of my most popular episodes have been about data and the internet of water and all this kind of info management stuff. So it's obviously a really hot issue that a lot of people are interested in. I think this will be a popular episode for sure. What was the problem with water data in California that kind of led to the creation of the consortium?
Yeah, so we are the California Water Data Consortium, and we obviously care immensely about water data here, both in California and beyond. But I just want to be really clear that we care about data and access to high quality data that can be shared and integrated across regions that results in better, but with the idea that that will result in better, more sustainable water management outcomes for all Californians. And that really is the goal and what motivates and why I think people understand that data is so important is because it really has the power to change people's lives in really important ways, particularly when we're talking about things like water data and ecological data. And so let me back up just a little bit before I talk about what motivated, I'll talk a little bit about what motivated the formation of the California Water Data Consortium before I talk about some of the data issues that are fundamental that we're trying to tackle. So from 2012 to 2016, California had a severe and historic drought that required state and local agencies to make decisions about where water use needed to be cut back. And while they were grappling with those decisions, it really became clear that both state and local agencies did not have the information that they needed to make well-informed decisions about where those cutbacks or conservation measures should take place and how successful they were when they actually happened. And so the real challenge is, or the real issue is that we live in a state with a thriving technology sector. It's home to the fifth largest economy in the world, and yet we lack basic information about how much water is being used for what purpose and at what time. And even when agencies report those data to the state, there are often data quality issues that can render them either unusable or really hinder their long-term usability. Or when they are reported, it's often once or twice a year. And so they certainly aren't available to make these sort of real-time critical management decisions that I talked about previously, when, you know, species or communities are really at risk. Additionally, there are many, many of the data that are reported to the state are reported in slightly different formats at different time frames using slightly different nomenclatures, which can make integrating them across regions very challenging. So it's hard to get these broader perspectives that are actually required when we think about trying to make sort of regional water management decisions or statewide water management decisions. And all of this ultimately impedes our ability to manage creatively across geographies, to manage resiliently, particularly during these dry periods. And we all know that climate change is going to tax our already taxed water system with more frequent and longer dry periods, earlier spring runoff that has the potential to lead to increased flooding, also in association with higher, more intense rainfall periods. So we need to really have a more comprehensive understanding of our water management system that will enable us to make more proactive decisions than sort of the reactive way that we've been managing to this point in time. And to be frank, we're heading into another dry summer right now here in California. And so we're all, I think, acutely aware of the need to improve how we've managed during these dry periods in the past to protect species, communities, and individuals at risk of, you know, in excess access to safe and affordable drinking water, as well as species who are critically endangered and really suffering during these dry periods, and growers and the communities that they support, as well as the urban centers who, you know, really enacted very, very robust conservation measures during the last drought. But we really need to have better information about how successful all of those programs fit together.
And I guess you kind of alluded to this, the size of California, the diversity of California, these are challenges as well when it comes to that data management, right? You have a lot of different types of water resources. And then given the size of the state, there's all these different water districts and boards and agencies. And so all of that complicates the picture, huh?
Absolutely. And I mean, you'll hear that time and again in California is there's a whole host of different jurisdictional. So there's a lot of fragmentation that occurs in water management in California and a lot of different geographies as well. And each water management system is unique. They have their own systems. They have their own way of managing. They have their own local context that really needs to be part of the equation as we think about all of this. And again, it leads back to why having data and information to really manage across that spectrum is so important.
So how was the California Water Data Consortium created? It's kind of a unique occurrence here and really interesting approach. I'd love to hear that story.
Yeah. So in 2016, sort of at the height of this most recent drought that I was just talking about, I mentioned that it became clear that California really needed to do something to address the many data challenges that I've talked about previously and to make data more accessible at local, regional, and statewide scales to better support water management decisions and to make those data more accessible to the public and to the many, many sectors involved in water management decisions here in California. So in 2016, the California legislature passed what's called the Open and Transparent Water Data Act, and it's one of the most robust pieces of legislation of water data legislation in the U.S. and globally. And what it does is it requires state agencies to make existing water and ecological publicly available, make those data sets publicly available on open data platforms, and to update them quarterly. Similarly, it requires water and ecological data sets related to California water supply that are held by federal agencies available on these platforms and then to update them quarterly. However, as they were drafting this legislation, there was a realization that the state could meet the legislative mandates as laid out, as I just laid out, without actually meeting sort of the broader legislative goals of making sure that the data were actually useful, they were sufficient to make well-informed water management decisions, and that they were broadly accessible. And so the legislators understood that achieving these goals would actually require ongoing collaboration and dialogue, both between state agencies and non-state agency representatives, including water agencies, tribes, academia, the private sector, NGOs, and others. And so what they did is, and for them to really get together and have ongoing dialogue and opportunities for projects to really try and make informed decisions that would benefit all of these different groups. And so the bill ended up including a clause that allowed the Department of Water Resources to partner with a nonprofit organization to create, operate, and maintain the data platform. And that really is the genesis of the California Water Data Consortium. And so we were formed as that nonprofit organization to bring together state and non-state agency representatives to jointly make decisions about how water data in California should be governed.
Hmm. I'm really curious about then what the work is. So they created this consortium to be the center point here. How's the work conducted? What does the consortium then do?
Yeah. So, why don't I talk a little bit more, a little bit more about our governance structure, and then I'll give just a few examples of some of the pilot projects that we're doing that to really demonstrate the value of open and transparent water data. And then we can talk maybe a little bit more later about some of those specifically.
Yeah, because I know that the board of the consortium is a really diverse group, and that's very interesting, and I think tells a lot about the mission and the work and where it resides. So go ahead with the governance.
Sure. Yeah. So the idea of this ongoing partnership and dialogue between state and non-state agency representatives is really at the heart of the consortium. And to facilitate this dynamic, we have this somewhat complex governance structure, which was developed and includes a 9-member board that, as you said, represents a diversity of interests, and they oversee sort of the strategic operations and core operations of the consortium. And it's complemented by an 11-member steering committee that includes 6 state agency representatives and 5 non-state agency representatives, again, across a variety of different interest groups. And they oversee the consortium's programmatic work. And so our programmatic work then develops through 2 working groups, 1 technical working group and 1 data users working group, that jointly advance pilot projects to address sort of key water management opportunities. So right now we have 4 pilot projects that we're advancing, and I'll just touch briefly on each of them. And then if you want to talk in more detail about any of them, I'm happy to fill in some gaps as well.
Sure.
So the first is a partnership with the Department of Conservation to identify critical gaps in LIDAR coverage in California. And for those who may not be familiar, LIDAR is a remote sensing method that provides high resolution information about the Earth's surface. And if you image through time, you can get a sense of how things are changing. And it has a whole host of applications, from estimating the amount of runoff from seasonal snowpack to understanding changes in infrastructure to identifying areas at risk of landslide after wildfire. So it's an amazing set of data that you can use to do a whole host to understand a whole host of different applications once you've collected it, but it's very expensive to collect. And so the goal with this pilot project is to bring together federal, state, and local agencies to, in a collaborative effort, to pool resources and consider data sharing models to support ongoing statewide LIDAR data collection. The second pilot project focuses on groundwater data, and there's really two components to this work. The first is working with the Department of Water Resources and the State Board to develop jointly or co-develop groundwater data, groundwater elevation data, best management practices that state and local agencies could adopt. And once developed, these data standards would facilitate data sharing across local agencies and state agencies, as well as between regulatory programs, which will ultimately save, you know, both state and local agencies a lot of time and money as they report and integrate these data through time. The second component to that one is a collaboration between the consortium and the Environmental Defense Fund, who have been working with a technology firm and a local water management agency to develop a water accounting and trading platform. And so the goal is to take that existing open source platform, expand and scale it to be available as a voluntary platform for water managers to use to easily sort of track water use across their basin and make decisions about how they can sort of achieve long-term sustainability there. The third is focused on urban water management, and local urban water management agencies report a whole host of different data to the state. It often has some similarities, but the format in which it's reported and the timeframes across which it's reported vary quite broadly. And so part of the work we're doing here is to dig into those reports and see where the opportunities to either look for ways to streamline how that data can be reported and made available in a more standardized format, again, to facilitate sharing across both local and state agencies. And then the final one is working with the Delta Measurement Experimentation Consortium to develop a Delta Alternative Compliance Plan for measuring and reporting water use under state statutes that require that all surface water or nearly all surface water diversions be accurately measured and reported to the state annually. And this has been an ongoing challenge for those who are familiar with California's San Joaquin Delta. Getting accurate estimates of water usage there has been particularly challenging. And so in this partnership, it's the Delta Measurement Experimentation Consortium, the California Water Data Consortium, and OpenET, which is a relatively new web-based platform that uses publicly available data and open source models to provide satellite-based information on evapotranspiration, and as well as a partnership with the State Water Resources Control Board to develop a software bridge, essentially, for lack of a better term, to integrate information from the state board's water rights information with field level estimates of crop evapotranspiration to estimate crop water use and report that information to the state. And so the goal with this one is really to streamline reporting of accurate and timely information to the state in a region where getting those accurate estimates in the past of water use has been particularly challenging. So that's just a sort of a broad overview of some of the work that we're doing.
Well, I mean, that's you say pilot projects, but those are four huge important buckets of water data and topics for California, right? Groundwater, such a critical issue. The urban water situation, what's happening in the Delta, being able to get a better understanding of situations with LIDAR. So you have your hands full already there with those four, I'd say. And I guess transparency is a big part of all of this. That was the point. So all the work that you're doing, the things that's happening with these pilots, the results, the information is being kind of put up there and for anyone to be able to see as it goes along.
That's exactly right. So because we evolved out of the Open and Transparent Water Data Act, everything that we're doing has to comply and the data that are being collected. Again, it's all data that's being reported publicly already to state agencies, but part of what we're doing is ensuring that that is then available on these open data platforms that were developed under the Open and Transparent Water Data Act. So yes, absolutely. It's a huge component.
Sure. So are there other efforts around the country that are somewhat similar? Or I know that other states may be trying to clean up their data, if you will, or different organizations looking to deal with data. Just curious as kind of what else you see on the U.S. landscape when it comes to water data and what you might be looking at and you know, monitoring, if you will.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So there are certainly ongoing efforts across the state, and we're seeing these evolve through time. So a good example would be that we're currently the New Mexico is a great example of a very similar structure. And I think you actually had Stacey Timmons on speaking previously about the Water Data Act that was passed in New Mexico and some of the data work that they're doing there. But what they have done is establish a fairly similar model, but that is still overseen within the state government. So I think what is particularly unique about our model is that it's an entirely separate organization that partners very, very closely with state agencies, but it's a different organization and an entirely separate organization that provides a venue, a separate sort of objective venue for stakeholders and the public to really weigh in on water governance systems in the state. But we're seeing a lot of other efforts like this. So the Western States Water Council, I think I got that acronym wrong, so sorry about that. But they have developed the Water Data Exchange, which has really done a lot of fantastic work to pull together water data across the 17 Western states and make those data transparent. The Internet of Water with Peter Callahan is another effort that is just, really bringing water data to the fore and really thinking about how do we ensure that these data are accessible for people to make good decisions about this essential public resource.
Mm. Yeah, it's interesting to see all those efforts kind of take shape and take place. And it makes sense that, like, you know, the Western states a water council, that they work on something regionally because water doesn't really know boundary, you know, political boundaries, right? It's going to flow state to state, watershed to watershed, and people making decisions about that water management need to have a holistic view of what's going on. You mentioned the nonprofit status. So how are you funded then? It's always... funding, financing, money is always an important question. How do these things get paid for?
Yeah. So let me, you kind of asked two questions in there. Okay. So let me start with why is the nonprofit status important? Mm-hmm. Because I think that's a really critical question. And then let's transition to the funding.
Sure.
Piece. So it might be easier for me to answer the why is the nonprofit status important? Easier to answer that with a question with a response about what the consortium isn't. And so importantly, the consortium is not a regulatory entity, and nor do we have taxing authority. And this is really by design. When the consortium was originally envisioned, there was a Water Data Advisory Council that did a lot of thinking about the organization, its goals, its governance structures, and they identified two key reasons for developing an independent nonprofit organization. Firstly, they recognize that the consortium would need to be nimble and flexible and able to adapt to new opportunities as they arise. The second piece is that they realized for the consortium's long-term success, that it would rely on its ability to establish and serve as this neutral space that could bring together state and non-state agency representatives to work together and not be vested to a single interest group. And so the decision was made to incorporate as a nonprofit organization that would serve or that would derive funding from a variety of sources rather than being beholden to a single sector or interest group. So I'm hoping that answers the first portion of the question as to why our nonprofit status is important. And then I'll transition to talk a little bit about how we are actually funded. So the consortium has received generous financial support from both philanthropy through the S.D. Bechtel Jr. Foundation, as well as the Water Foundation. We've also received funding from several urban water management districts, our urban water districts and irrigation districts in California's Central Valley. So this includes Metropolitan Water District, Rosedale Rio Bravo Water Storage District in Kern County in California's Central Valley, Moulton Nagal Water District, as well as members of the Bay Area Agency or Bay Area Agencies Coalition. And ultimately, they have made these donations because they recognize the potential benefits of streamlined reporting, as well as better, just, you know, the benefits of statewide data to better support water management decisions within their local agencies. And from a philanthropic standpoint, they really want to see improved access and see the value of open and transparent water data to inform broader water management in California across the state. And so we are actively working now. So that's sort of initial like startup funding that we've gotten, and we're working now to really build out a sustainable funding model that will be a mix of a variety across a variety of funding streams from urban and agricultural water districts, philanthropy, the state, private sector, as well as grants. We're also soliciting grants or donations, and you can donate on our website. So I'll put a shameless plug in for that, but it's California Water or cawaterdata.org. So that's something that we spend quite a bit of time working on right now, is really building out this more sustainable funding model long term.
Sure, absolutely. I'm curious, it's a pretty new entity, right? Just kind of set up a few years ago. You've had to do a lot of kind of initial work and setting things up, launching these pilots. I don't think your work will ever be done, right? This data always has to be managed. But are you, where are you on that journey of getting things going and getting to a point where, okay, we have our arms around the data now. People can see the data. Things are flowing pretty well. I guess, is that kind of the goal, is to get to that state? And where are you on that journey?
Yeah, so the consortium was formed in 2019, and I came on last year, so 2020. And, you know, I think the consortium is in its infancy, and I think California has a lot of, I think California and really statewide, or sorry, across the U.S., we have a lot of work to do in terms of really understanding and valuing water as the essential resource that it is. But at the same time, I am so encouraged by the interest, the willingness, and the value that people really see. And there has been just a dramatic shift in the past 5 years in how we think about and value water and the data necessary to manage it sustainably. So I guess my long-term vision for the consortium would be sort of a resilient and equitable water future for all Californians, where trusted, open, and accessible water and ecological data are used to inform all water management decisions across the state. So we do have a long way to go to get to that vision. But just the fact that we are seeing so much interest and so many agencies willing to come together and start to have conversations to achieve that long-term vision is just really encouraging. And I think we are already on that track here. So
that's awesome. Good stuff. Well, I would love to follow up with you in the future on these specific pilots and kind of hear about the outcomes and the, you know, the real world application of some of this data management. It's exciting stuff, really important. And I'm, you know, being on the East Coast here, I'm thinking of all you in California. I've seen the news about the predictions for the dry summer and the water supplies, and know that, you know, it's going to be conservation and efficiency are going to be really critical in the months ahead for y'all. But Tara, thank you for your time and for all this information. Appreciate it so much.
Yeah, thank you so much, Travis. It's been a pleasure.
Go ahead, Chris.
Yep. No, I didn't say anything.
Oh, sorry. I heard an echo.
KCAA Loma Linda, 1050 AM, 106.5 FM, and now 102.3 FM.
The administration lays out its plan to share vaccine doses with the world as vaccination demands.